These embassies act as control centers for the North's regional smuggling networks and other plainly illicit operations.
ASEAN members urge North Korea to stop missile and nuclear programs. It's Monday, August 7th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Join us. Also ahead, the South China Sea, discussed at ASEAN. Conservation groups protest illegal ivory trade, China's growing love for fast cars, beer to make you healthier, and digital nomads. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi held a bilateral meeting with his North Korean counterpart Ri Yong-ho Sunday on the sidelines of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations ministerial meetings in Manila. Wang said he urged Ri to adhere to UN resolutions and stop provoking the international community's goodwill with missile launches and nuclear tests. Wang also said he advised his North Korean counterpart to take a double suspension approach to easing tensions on the Korean Peninsula, an approach calling for the suspension of North Korea's nuclear tests and the suspension of joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. Spokesman Robespierre Bolivar said the statement, the second by the ASEAN this year, was born of the Southeast Asia's proximity to North Korea and an increase in weapons tests. North Korea has tested missiles, including an ICBM, seven times since April, as Bolivar told the news conference Saturday, while declining to answer a question about U.S. pressure.
The North Koreans have tested more weapons in the past couple of months of 2017 than previously. And this is a statement of that concern. Of course, primarily geographically, the Korean Peninsula is very close to us.
A warning to North Korea by foreign ministers from the 10 ASEAN countries is expected to sue the U.S. government, which the ministers hope will play a stronger role in their region. At the same time, they hope to protect their own ties with Pyongyang. On Saturday, ASEAN ministers expressed grave concern about escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula, including North Korea's intercontinental ballistic test in July and two recent nuclear tests. It asked North Korea to fulfill all UN Security Council obligations and quit the tests. ASEAN's foreign ministers said in a statement at a meeting in Manila that they want to help improve relations between North and South Korea. The 10 ASEAN countries recognize North Korea diplomatically, and North Korea has embassies in eight of them, forming an outlet for the hermit state's money-making activities abroad. Sean King, senior vice president of the New York-based political consultancy Park Strategies, says some North Korean embassies effectively do business for Kim Jong-un's government, possibly tempering any resolve Southeast Asia has to upset it.
In addition to supporting ostensibly legitimate businesses like ginseng sales and restaurants, these embassies act as control centers for the North's regional smuggling networks and other plainly illicit operations.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on his first official trip to Southeast Asia as the United States continues to call for a legally binding mechanism to prevent conflicting territorial claims in the South China Sea from erupting into violent confrontations. Tillerson is also seeking greater cooperation from regional allies in isolating North Korea. VOA Cindy Sain tells us more on the background of Tillerson's efforts in this report written by State Department correspondent Nike Ching.
After a stern warning from China, Vietnam called off the permission to an energy company to drill for gas in the South China Sea. It is the latest chapter in the ongoing dispute over the world's most contested waterway that is believed to be rich in resources. Foreign ministers from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations are expected to endorse the framework of a code of conduct on the South China Sea as they gather in Manila. While the framework commits to cooperation over confrontation, it is also seen as bending to China's influence since it is not legally binding. The U.S. will continue to press for a dispute resolution mechanism and uphold freedom of navigation.
Destabilizing actions such as Chinese land reclamation, construction, and militarization of disputed features makes it harder for the region to resolve these disagreements peacefully.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wants to work with China on differences without leading to open conflict. Among them is stepping up pressure against North Korea.
There is no future where North Korea holds nuclear weapons or the ability to deliver those nuclear weapons to anyone in the region, much less to the homeland. In doing so, we've sought to partner with China. China does account for 90% of economic activity with North Korea.
Tillerson will be walking a fine line with the Southeast Asian bloc, seeking assurances from them to isolate Pyongyang without creating a perception that North Korea overshadows their concerns in the South China Sea.
And the fact is that North Korea matters a lot less for Malaysia or Vietnam or the Philippines than South China Sea does, which is right at their front door.
Others warn regional allies are starting to believe they may not get practical support from Washington in the South China Sea disputes. Bill Hayton from Chatham House spoke via Skype.
They felt that the Trump administration couldn't be relied upon to protect Vietnam's interests in such a confrontation. So I suppose this is a sign that governments in Southeast Asia are concerned that the Trump administration isn't interested in defending their interests.
Besides maritime security and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, regional counterterrorism is said to be also high on the ASEAN agenda. For State Department correspondent Nike Ching, this is Cindy Sain in Washington.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. China presses North Korea to halt missile and nuclear tests. Gritty talks ahead as China and ASEAN agree to avoid mishaps in disputed sea. Myanmar rejects allegations of human rights abuses against Rohingya. Chinese official fired for not fighting extremism. Exhibit on Khmer Rouge atrocities aims to prevent another genocide. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and there's much more, when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China and a group of 10 Southeast Asian nations face tough negotiations on a code of conduct for avoiding mishaps in the contested South China Sea, despite the endorsement of a framework for talks. Experts say Beijing will oppose defining the scope of the sea, making the code binding, and any enforcement that would limit its maritime activities, whereas the Association of Southeast Asian Nations is asking for those details and discussions to go on. The deal has dragged since 2002, with China resisting for much of the past 6 years. China and ASEAN foreign ministers approved a framework code in Manila Sunday. Jonathan Spangler is director of the South China Sea think tank in Taipei.
If and when a code of conduct is finalized, we can rest assured that it will be diluted to a point where it does not damage Chinese interests in the South China Sea.
Beijing claims more than 90% of the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea, overlapping smaller tracts that Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines say fall under their own flags. The code of conduct would be aimed at avoiding accidents as the claimant countries fish, explore for oil and gas, or develop some of the estimated 500 tiny islets. Vietnam and China clashed in 1974, 1988, and again in 2014, the first two fights deadly, and the latest case over a Chinese oil rig. The code would aim to prevent more such incidents, but as the strongest, most aggressive claimant, China may fear that a code of conduct would expose or curb some of its maritime activities. Since 2010, it has alarmed the Southeast Asian states by passing Coast Guard boats through their waters while using landfill to create artificial islets in the Paracel and Spratly chains, some apparently for military installations such as radar systems and combat aircraft. Yoon Sun is East Asia Program Senior Associate at the Stimson Center think tank in Washington.
I think from the standpoint of ASEAN members, they will want this document to be legally binding. And this is predictable because if you are the weaker party, you want to have the law at your back. But from Chinese point of view, making it legally binding effectively means binding its hands and you potentially restrict its freedom.
ASEAN members seek a legally binding code, possibly ratified by their respective legislatures, with an enforcement scheme and ways of monitoring any incidents. Although the code is not supposed to touch on anyone's sovereignty claim, ASEAN may ask that the code include a clear sea boundary. Experts say China is likely to protest any eventual code clauses on enforcement, legal authority, and South China Sea boundaries that cover islands, such as the Paracels that it controls outright. Beijing cites historical usage records as a basis for its claim to the sea, extending from its south coast to Borneo. Happening now in Asia, Japan on Sunday marked the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. nuclear bombing of Hiroshima that led to the end of World War II. Around 140,000 people were killed either instantly or soon from radiation burns. 6 days after a second nuclear bomb attack on Nagasaki, Japan surrendered, ending the war. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for stopping by and listening. As many as 100 elephants are being killed every day for their tusks, according to the United Nations, China is the biggest market for poachers, and it recently announced it will end its ivory trade this year. The United States implemented a near-total ban on the commercial trade of African elephant ivory last year, and in New York, conservation groups gathered to destroy some of the merchandise that came from the illegal ivory trade. Faith Lapidus narrates this report from VOA's Kevin Enix.
Over the past century, elephant populations in the wild have plummeted from millions to about 500,000, all because of ivory.
You see this piece here in front of us. The top, this one piece here, 5 juvenile elephants were killed to make that small piece. Today, we are going to crush approximately 100 elephants. That is the number of elephants that die approximately every day in Africa.
This is literally millions of dollars worth of confiscated ivory, and the main reason that the groups say elephants are being killed every day.
A two-year period from 2010 to 2012, 100,000 elephants were slaughtered so that someone could have something like this in their living room? It disgusts me. Who said it before? Commissioner, you said it's disgusting.
All the ivory being crushed was seized in undercover investigations that brought in nearly 3 tons of illegal carvings and jewelry. But there is some reason to be hopeful. The U.S. and China have committed to ending the trade. And New York has passed anti-ivory laws because it is one of the largest entry points for illegal ivory. The organizers of this event say they're trying to send a simple message.
To say to the world, just in case you are contemplating buying ivory and you're not sure of the legality of it, don't buy it.
The organizers say they're fighting elephant extinction and want to make sure that carved ivory isn't going to be the only thing that remains of these iconic animals. For writer Kevin Enox, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Philippines government is considering how to rebuild Marawi City after months of clashes in which Islamic militants displaced 400,000 people and left much of the city's infrastructure severely damaged. Stop by VOA Asia Facebook daily for the latest in Asia. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, after co-sponsoring the seventh running of the three-nation two-week-long Silk Way Rally, as well as hosting the Shanghai Grand Prix Formula One race circuit since 2004, along with, well, a lot of local car rallies, China is showing a growing interest in motorsports. The China Passenger Car Association said car sales last year in China approached 24 million. That's nearly a 15% increase over 2015, and it makes China the world's top car market. Despite urban pollution and traffic congestion, China's fascination with the automobile and racing reflect its growing middle class and economic clout. Eric Harwood is professor of Asia Studies at the East-West Institute in Hawaii, and he follows the Chinese car market. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty motorsports has followed a natural progression for China.
They've become a society that wants to use their cars not just for commuting, but to go out in the countryside, to have picnics, to travel around the country, or maybe even outside of the country. And now this is the next step, to use cars for motorsports and to enjoy watching people racing cars, see how fast they can go. The element of speed comes into their love of sports. So this is just kind of a natural progression, I think, from people who, as you said, 30 years ago were riding bicycles, or if they had a car, it was maybe a very old Chinese domestically made vehicle. Now they're able to see the latest sports cars zooming around modern tracks built in their own country.
Are these Chinese-made cars, or are they vehicles from all over the world?
The race cars would be vehicles from all over the world. I don't think the Chinese domestic makers are quite up to that level where they can manufacture the cutting-edge race cars. So I think it's the Toyotas and the Hondas and Fords and other vehicle producers, Ferraris from around the world that are actually making the vehicles that the Chinese are watching.
Well, you've got hundreds of local car rallies going on, motocross events, touring car championships. You even got this two-week-long Silkway Odyssey across the desert. They're getting in quite a few different sporting events in the car racing industry.
Especially, as you say, this international race is really something that piques people's interest. The Chinese are very curious about foreign countries, so when they get to see cars traveling across Russia and Kazakhstan and various other countries in Central Asia, in their own far west, they not only see the excitement of the racing, but they also have a chance to maybe learn a little bit about those other cultures where the cars are passing through.
Is this happening all across the country? We know that there is a real air pollution problem in some of China's bigger cities.
China has limited real estate, so many of these race tracks will be built out in the countryside. So in areas where I think there's less pollution.
How does the Chinese Communist Party, which of course controls much of the life in China, look at growing interest in overseas foreign sports like basketball, U.S.-style football, and now motor car racing?
Well, the Chinese want to be a global power, not just in the economy, not just, I guess many would say, in the military, but also they want to be a sports power. If they want to compete at the Olympics, if they want to be seen as national champions in the kind of things that people follow, which is in many cases sports, then they have to be players.
Eric Harwood said he expects world-ranked Chinese race car drivers in the next 5 to 10 years. It's easy to follow because both popular writer, blogger, and film director Han Han and actor Jimmy Lin are race car drivers. Developing at this hour in Asia, China has set a goal of eliminating poverty by the year 2020, but questions remain whether the country will help geographically isolated communities such as the Yi ethnic group. China has set itself the goal of lifting 10 million people out of poverty every year from 2016. See the day's top stories every day on VOA 60. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, evidence of the role that a healthy gut plays in overall human health, both physical and even mental, is growing every day. To strengthen gut health, food researchers are trying to incorporate live bacteria called probiotics into all kinds of products. And as VOA's Kevin Enix reports, that's even beer.
Beer can be traced back in time nearly 4,000 years to a Sumerian rock tablet recipe. It's still really popular, but it is also alcoholic and not particularly good for you. That, however, may be changing.
Beer is, firstly, it's a challenging environment, so if you are able to incorporate probiotics, it'll be a big breakthrough. And also because beer is something that is a beverage that will never die, it's frequently drink at social events. So in a way, there's huge market potential as well.
Researchers in Singapore have been working for some time to keep gut bacteria, called probiotics, alive in beer. The problem is that beer and probiotics don't tend to get along very well.
Hops is the main ingredient that kills probiotics, so we have to find a way in order to allow the probiotics to overcome the hops. So this process, actually, it's quite tedious.
But they've done it, and here's the proof. Beer packed with gut bacteria that can improve your intestinal health and strengthen the immune system.
So the taste of the beer, it's a sour beer, so it will taste sour because of the probiotics that produce lactic acid. But at the same time, besides sour, it also has hints of fruitiness. And the alcohol content is around 3.5%, around the same percentage as other commercial sour beers.
Look at the bubbling. This is all natural. I didn't put anything else besides fruits and all that.
Melissa Mack sells kombucha, a fermented mixture of tea and yeast that also claims to have health benefits. Mack says she's willing to give a probiotic beer a try.
So on one hand, you're thinking, beer, that doesn't sound like a good thing at all, but yet, you know, you're adding stuff like bacteria and yeast that's relevant, like lactobacillus, which is something that makes it a bit more sour. So you're thinking, okay, is this healthy or is this not healthy? No one knows for sure.
The researchers are currently in talks with beer companies that might be willing to mass produce and market the beverage. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
We've certainly seen digital technology is changing how people live and work, and there are now so-called digital nomads who move from city to city as they explore new places and cultures while earning a paycheck. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan spoke to some digital nomads about their lifestyle, which is made possible by easy travel and modern technology.
Phil Palin is a brand strategist who works in Los Angeles at a shared workspace alongside entrepreneurs and professionals who are running their businesses. He works from places like this around the world.
A few weeks ago, I was in an airplane for 41 hours of that week, and I actually did a full loop around the world. LA, Europe, Middle East, Asia, back to LA.
He sets up space as needed in the facilities of a company that offers co-working spaces in 50 cities around the world. Fanny Valise also takes her work on the road. An actress and producer who runs her own company, she works from a shared workspace as she helps other filmmakers get their movies financed and distributed.
We focus on diversity, creating opportunities for people of color and other underrepresented groups in the entertainment business.
One current project explores an American family's links with Mexico.
We use social media. We do a lot of crowdfunding campaigns.
She does it wherever she needs to, in different parts of the United States or in Mexico. Another digital nomad, an American product manager, is working from Taiwan and spoke via Skype.
Now, you know, I've met account managers, you know, who work with clients just remotely. I met like lots of marketing people. I've met nursing faculty, so like people that teach for universities and they conduct their classes online.
In Los Angeles or New York, the limits are disappearing, says a technology expert who also spoke via Skype.
So it changes someone's creativity level. Local has a harder time competing now with global, number one. Number two, someone who lives farther away from New York can create something and sell it in New York instantly or in Beijing or anywhere.
He says as geographical boundaries become less important for people in many types of work, their horizons are expanded. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This programming note, on this anniversary of the Hiroshima atomic bombing, we'd like to tell you about a very special Japanese bonsai that has been on display here in the United States at the National Arboretum in Washington. It's now 392 years old. Right. Besides its ancient age, the white pine survived the atomic bomb dropped over the city, and the bonsai master who owned that tree donated it to the United States in 1976 for the bicentennial celebration. VOA's Allison Ogden visited the bonsai tree last week. She spoke with its curator. It's on Facebook at VOA Asia. Check it out. We'd like to hear what you think. We thank you so much for joining us today. And we'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Aydin Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Ali Ogden and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.